KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Oh, we'll come down so hard if they do anything to our people. We'll come down so hard, and then the gloves are off so beautifully.
President Trump has escalated his rhetoric against Iran, including threatening the country's supreme leader in a social media message.
It's Tuesday, June 17th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The man suspected of killing a Minnesota state lawmaker and her husband and wounding another lawmaker and his wife faces federal and state murder charges.
There has been focus on his religious connections.
There's been a decided uptick in the rhetoric and vision of violence in the United States from apostolic leaders for some time.
Also, how one Kansas town is working to improve quality of life across generations.
And when egg prices skyrocketed, some people rented chickens.
Boom, there we go. We didn't have chickens one day, and then we had a whole setup the next.
First the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Israel is claiming to have killed a top Iranian general as the two sides continue to trade strikes. Meanwhile, U.S. President Donald Trump today again warned residents of Tehran they should evacuate, as he seemed to suggest. The U.S. has given up on negotiations between the two sides. Trump left a group of seven meeting in Canada early, citing the need to return to Washington to deal with the escalating conflict between Israel and Iran. Trump has said he wants a real end to the conflict, which has claimed lives on both sides over the past several days. Top law enforcement officials on Capitol Hill briefed senators on security protocols today following the targeted political assassination of one Minnesota state lawmaker and the attempted assassination of another over the weekend. More from NPR's Deidre Walsh.
Senators from both parties say the Capitol Police need more money to investigate threats and step up security for lawmakers. Connecticut Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal says he doesn't plan to change how he does his job.
The solution here is not to limit accessibility. It's to provide security and deter these incidences of political violence.
Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn says there has to be a balance when it comes to adding resources.
It's trying to make sure that it's proportional to the threat and not an overreaction.
Congress could increase the U.S. Capitol Police's budget in the annual spending bill for the agency this fall to address the uptick in threats. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, the Capitol.
Medicaid has been getting a lot more attention. That's according to a new poll out today. As NPR's Selena Simmons Duffin reports, the spike in popularity comes as Republican lawmakers finalize a tax and spending bill that could cut $800 billion from the program.
Medicaid has always been quite popular. In January, a poll from the health research organization KFF found 77% of the public had a favorable view of the health insurance program for low-income people. Just a few months later, it's gone up. 83% of the public is now in favor of Medicaid. Ashley Kurzinger is KFF's polling expert.
The largest uptick we saw in favorability over the past couple months was among Republicans.
The findings come as Republican lawmakers rush to finish a major legislative package that would include significant cuts to federal spending on Medicaid. Selena Simmons Duffin, NPR News.
Retail sales took a tumble in May as consumers pulled back a bit on their spending, seeking to get ahead of the Trump administration's tariffs. Sales at retail stores and restaurants fell 0.9% in May after a smaller drop the previous month. A major falloff in auto sales was partly to blame, since earlier in the year there was a wave of buying by consumers looking to beat possible tariff-related price increases. On Wall Street today, the Dow fell 299 points. You're listening to NPR. President Trump has nominated Ted Cook to be the next commissioner at the Bureau of Reclamation. From member station KUNC, Alex Hager reports he'll be the top federal official working on the Colorado River.
Cook spent 7 years managing the Central Arizona Project, which brings Colorado River water to the Phoenix area. Sharon Megdal used to work alongside Cook. She's now a water policy expert at the University of Arizona.
I have great admiration for Ted's skills. He's thorough, he's deliberative, he looks for solutions. And boy, we need to find solutions right now.
If confirmed, Cook will step into the role as seven Western states are in the middle of tense negotiations about how to cut back on water use. He and other federal leaders will try to bring them toward agreement about sharing the shrinking water supply for 40 million people. For NPR News, I'm Alex Hager in Fort Collins, Colorado.
It's considered to be the biggest jewelry heist in U.S. history, and it was never solved, that is perhaps until now. Authorities saying that charges and arrests have been made in the case in which about $100 million in jewels were taken from the back of a Brinks semi-truck while at a highway rest stop in California in 2022. A total of seven men are accused of scouting the truck as it left a jewelry show, while others followed the vehicle along a 300-mile journey before they allegedly grabbed diamonds, rubies, gold, and luxury watches. It occurred between San Mateo and Pasadena. Some of the jewelry was recovered this month when search warrants were executed. Crude oil futures prices continue to surge amid escalating tensions in the Mideast. Oil up 4% today to $74.97 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Trump today called Iran's supreme leader an easy target, but said that he's not looking to, quote, kill him, but that could change. The clear threat against Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is a significant escalation of Trump's position over the last week. He previously had distanced himself from Israeli military action against Iran, but now he is taking some credit. NPR's Franco Ordonez joins us from the White House with the latest. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
So, Franco, I know that the president cut his trip to the G7 summit in Canada short because of this escalating conflict. What has he been doing since?
Yeah, he got back early this morning, and this afternoon he huddled with his national security team in the Situation Room for about an hour. That was after he issued the pointed threats and warnings. Trump said, quote, "We now have total and complete control over the skies over Iran," and called for Iran to unconditionally surrender. Now, this is really a significant escalation in a conflict that now is into its fifth day. On the way back from Canada, reporters on Air Force One actually asked Trump what he wants to see happen now, and he told them he wants something bigger than a ceasefire.
An end. A real end, not a ceasefire. An end.
So something that would be permanent.
Yeah, or giving up entirely. That's okay, too.
Okay, Franco, we've been tracking this, and as I understand it, the president previously was leaning into negotiations rather than military strikes, right?
Yeah, and this is really a significant pivot for Trump. I mean, when Israel launched its strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities last week, the White House emphasized that the U.S. was not involved. But now Trump's suggesting that the U.S. is involved. I mean, he's saying things like, we have total control of the skies. We know where the supreme leader is hiding. I mean, he's taking more ownership. You know, he went on to say that the supreme leader is safe for now, but indicated that that could change if civilians were targeted or American soldiers.
So no more diplomacy then?
No. I mean, it doesn't appear that he is even interested in diplomacy. I mean, he dismissed comments by the French president that Trump left early to seek a ceasefire. I mean, here is more of what Trump said on Air Force One when he was asked about negotiating.
The cities have been blown to pieces, lost a lot of people. They should have done the deal. I told them, do the deal. So I don't know. I'm not too much in a mood to negotiate.
Now, he's also saying, though, that he may send Vice President J.D. Vance and Special Envoy Steve Witkoff to negotiate with Iran.
Now, the U.S. has assisted with defense efforts of Israel. What are the chances, do you think, of deeper U.S. involvement?
You know, I mean, that's the big question, and it's the one that was likely the focus of these talks in the Situation Room today. I mean, I will say he's drawing a red line in certain areas with attacks on U.S. soldiers, with civilians, and he's leaving his options open. Now, some of his allies are pushing him to get more involved, such as Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, while other lawmakers, such as Representative Thomas Massie of Kentucky, are working to block any U.S. military involvement in the conflict without congressional approval. And just look at what he is signaling in his own words. You know, we this, we that. Again, he is taking ownership. And he says, quote, our patience is wearing thin. He's really blurring the lines of U.S. interests and Israeli interests. These are deliberate choices of words. I mean, it's so different than just what he was offering. I mean, it's very different than just offering Israel support.
That is NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez with the latest. Thank you so much, Franco.
Thank you, Juana.
All right, as we just heard, Israel and Iran have now been trading attacks for 5 days. Among the countries caught in the flight path between the two, Jordan and Lebanon. And people there are coping in different ways, as NPR's Jane Araf reports from Amman.
There's nothing more serious than war. The casualties, the destruction. The danger of being hit by shrapnel from weapons launched up to 1,000 miles away. The Jordanian and Lebanese governments are trying hard to stay out of the conflict. For most of their citizens, there's nothing they can do but watch. And that's exactly what many are doing. This is an extraordinary scene this weekend on a rooftop bar near Beirut. Lebanese musician Alain Otayek plays saxophone while guests snap photos of Iranian missiles streaking across the sky. In the viral video, he wears a multicolored kimono, and he really leans into the music. We caught up with Otayek by Zoom.
And at first, I thought it was a firework, and after I realized, no, it's not a firework because everybody was tense. So I decided to continue play and give this love to everyone who's feeling, emotionally disturbed and stuff like this to make them feel good.
Otayek, whose stage name is O. Allen Sachs, says bars and restaurants in Beirut are mostly still full. He says all the wars Lebanon has been through have made people here a bit different.
Me personally, I live in the moment, and be living in the moment and not focusing on what's happening around you with music will help you in this situation, you know what I mean?
Lebanon has been officially in a state of war with Israel for years. Despite a ceasefire in November, Israel is still launching airstrikes against the militant group Hezbollah. Lebanon really wants to stay out of this conflict, and in any case, has no real air force to speak of. Jordan, helped by U.S. air defenses, has been intercepting Iranian attacks aimed at Israel to minimize the danger to Jordanians. Air raid sirens have sounded several times a day since Israel began attacks on Iran. Jordan has a peace treaty with neighboring Israel. But Israel's war in Gaza against Hamas has killed more than 55,000 Palestinians. And there's no love lost for Israel here. Despite the danger, a lot of Jordanians have been brewing tea and going up on their roofs to watch the missiles when they hear the sirens at night. So many that the government has warned them to stay indoors. Jane Araf, NPR News, Amman.
When egg prices surged to record highs this year, so did the number of people who added egg-laying chickens to their backyard. As many as 11 million households have them, according to the American Pet Products Association. But for those who aren't ready to fully commit, renting is an option. Chicken rental businesses provide everything a person needs, the coop, the food, and the hens. Skylar Rossi with member station Harvest Public Media reports.
It's been just over a week that chickens have been living in Katie Hitt's backyard in St. Louis. And on this day, the four multicolored birds cluck as they snack on a treat of dried mealworms, which Hitt is shaking into the run of their coop. She and her family have enjoyed the pale blue eggs the hens lay, and her three young kids are having fun with the birds.
That's the first thing they're thinking of when they wake up in the morning is like, how are the chickens and what are they doing?
Local regulations for backyard chickens vary across the country. Hitt can only keep hens, not a rooster, in her backyard, and they must stay contained. She had wanted the birds for a while, but she was nervous about doing something wrong. She didn't know anyone with a backyard flock and was overwhelmed by the amount of advice online.
I'm looking at coops, and I'm looking at food, I'm looking at all these things, and I just wasn't sure what the right move would be.
But then Hitt heard about chicken rentals. She could have her birds and coop delivered right to her home, expert advice, and only a 1-year commitment. And renting was quick.
It was just like, boom, there we go. We didn't have chickens one day, and then we had a whole setup the next.
People flocked to get backyard chickens this year. Rent the Chicken, a national backyard rental business, opened over a decade ago. Co-founder Jen Tompkins says in some of their regions, all of their birds were rented by early May, which was unusual.
We've been so busy, we haven't even been able to compare numbers now versus last year. When we looked in February, we were already about 20% ahead on this year versus last year this time.
Hatcheries say they were also flooded with orders. Some point to the recent expensive egg prices and shortages as the reason why.
Things exploded, and it's almost 100% to do with eggs, and the cost of eggs specifically.
That's Tom Watkins, the president of Murray McMurray Hatchery in Webster City, Iowa, which sells about 3 million chicks a year to people across the U.S. Typically, the hatchery has its sales lined up a few weeks in advance. But this year, Watkins says they're sold out through October, the end of the season.
That's 40 weeks of chickens that are pre-sold. We have literally sold them, you know, counted them before they hatched. So
to be clear, even with the record high prices of eggs at the grocery store this year, you can expect to shell out more to keep the chickens. For example, in March, the average cost of a dozen eggs was $6.23. A person who bought a carton every week for a year at that price would spend about $320. However, Katie Bell, an agriculture educator with the University of Illinois Extension, says that all the supplies needed for chickens, like the coop and the fencing to protect them against predators, would cost more than that.
You could easily spend $500 before you even get the birds.
And that goes for renting chickens, too. In St. Louis, Emily and Tom Schnitzer opened four feathered hens at the beginning of this year. Their rental packages start at $95 per month for a year-long commitment. Emily says their most expensive package at $190 a month includes full care of the birds.
We'll come out, we'll feed the chickens, we'll change out the bedding in the coop, make sure everything is going smoothly, just so it's pretty much the family only has to collect the eggs.
Katie Hitt is renting from the Schnitzers. Her family is caring for the chickens themselves. Hitt says her kids are picky eaters, but they want to eat the eggs from their chickens.
This is like, oh, I know my chicken. You know, they're already deciding whose chicken is who. My chicken laid this one. I'm going to eat that one. And so it's really, really cute.
Hitt's not sure yet if she'll keep the chickens after the year is up, but for now, she's enjoying the experience. For NPR News, I'm Skylar Rossi in Columbia, Missouri.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Investigators are still determining the motive behind the killing of a Minnesota state representative and her husband over the weekend. They say that Vance Belter had a much larger list of people he was apparently planning to target, including other Democratic elected officials and abortion rights supporters. One area of his background is yielding some insight into the views he held about abortion, and that is his religious connections. NPR's domestic extremism correspondent, Odette Youssef, is here to discuss. Hi, Odette.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Okay, so what do we know about his religious connections, his religious background?
We know that he graduated from a school in Texas called the Christ for the Nations Institute, which has put out a statement condemning the violence and saying it's not what the school teaches. But the CFNI is considered to be a precursor to a movement that is now referred to as the New Apostolic Reformation. And we know that when Belter was in Africa 2 years ago, he spoke during sermons about his belief in modern day prophets and apostles in the U.S. And experts say this is distinct to NAR theology. And so, you know, now the NAR up until recently has been considered a fringe strand of the evangelical right. It's a neo-charismatic expression of Christianity.
Okay.
But, you know, a really important aspect of the NAR movement, Mary Louise, is its political aspirations. There's an idea they espouse called dominionism, and that is a belief that they are called to take control over every aspect of society to impose Old Testament biblical governance. And so this has been a powerful anti-democratic movement that has aligned itself with the MAGA movement and has also fed concerns about rhetoric that could inspire extremist violence.
Okay, a lot to take in there. You're talking about this has fed concerns about rhetoric could inspire extremist violence. Is there evidence that would actually give cause for concern that this faith community might turn to violence?
Well, some leading figures within the NAR were critical in mobilizing and fomenting anger within Trump's base in the period leading to the January 6th attack on the Capitol. But in the context of these attacks in Minnesota, you have to look at the language and framing around the topic of abortion. Fred Clarkson from Political Research Associates says there's reason to be concerned that the NAR is priming the pump for this kind of violence.
There's been a decided uptick in the rhetoric and vision of violence in the United States from apostolic leaders for some time.
And within that rhetoric, Mary Louise, you'll hear abortion discussed as ritual child sacrifice and as something that empowers demons.
Can we connect this, though? Can we connect extreme rhetoric with the violence we just saw in Minnesota?
So we know that Belter railed against abortion in America during at least one sermon abroad, so it was an issue he cared about. And there was an interesting detail in the federal complaint filed against Belter yesterday, which said that he sent a group text to his wife and other family members a few hours after the rampage occurred, and it said, "Dad went to war last night." This language of war is the language that the NAR uses when talking about taking dominion over society. Clarkson says it's clear who the enemies are in that war.
The NAR views historic Christian churches and civil government and its leaders as enemies, as, you know, infested with demons. These are things that they talk about all the time. The question is, at what point does the rhetoric meet the reality?
So in a sentence, Odette, is the case here that the rhetoric met the reality?
I think it's hard to say at this point, Mary Louise, but we will be learning more as the investigation continues.
That's NPR's Odette Youssef. Thank you.
Thank you.
This week marks the 50th anniversary of the release of Jaws, a movie that terrified generations of beachgoers. And in honor of that anniversary, this week our friends at WNYC's Radio Lab are exploring the science of sharks. Here is a small slice of that featuring Radio Lab co-host Lulu Miller and reporter Rachel Cusick.
Like, Lulu, if you had to guess for 2024, last year,
mm-hmm.
do you want to guess, like, how many people died from shark attacks around the world?
How many people died?
Yes.
I don't know, like, maybe 970.
Okay, so take that number and subtract 963.
Seven people. Singular people.
Seven confirmed fatalities from sharks last year. Okay. So just to put that into perspective, these are a few of the things that will kill more humans than sharks every year.
Okay.
So at the beach alone, the things that are way more likely to get you at the beach are rip currents.
Water itself. Okay.
Skin cancer, huge one. And those are just at the beach.
Okay.
Zoom out a little bit.
Yeah.
Lightning strikes.
Are more than sharks?
Yeah. 24,000 people a year, apparently. Selfies.
That's so sad.
It's a really bad way to go.
Okay. So you're saying like...
Wait, sorry. One more.
Yep.
The one stat that I just love as a New Yorker is that you are 10 times more likely to be bitten by a New Yorker than you are to be bitten by a shark.
I kind of believe that. I get that. Okay. But. Sharks, man. Like, they are so fast and so big. And, like, I can hear these statistics, but if we're at the beach and you tell me there are sharks in the water, I'm not going to go in. Could it be analogous to a snake kind of fear where it's just like, or I don't happen to have it, but a spider fear where it's like we come out ready to be afraid of these things because it would have served us?
Yeah. Well, according to the scientist I spoke to named Chris Lowe,
professor of marine biology and the director of the shark lab at Cal State Long Beach.
That is totally true for some animals.
They're land animals that we co-evolve with that we have innate fear.
But not for sharks.
Psychologists have done studies where they've shown babies pictures of snakes and spiders and they react with fear. Then they show them a picture of a shark and there's no reaction.
Chris pointed out the obvious fact that
we're not an aquatic animal.
For most of human history, people had very few interactions with sharks.
It was this beast that people were told about that they rarely get to see.
And Chris says, when all you have are stories,
what happens is it allows people's imaginations to take over.
Like, we didn't have goggles until like the 1950s. So we knew that things were taking us. We never actually ever saw these creatures. Like, the most we might see is the fin.
We're given a few pieces of information, and then we begin to develop this image of what these animals are like. We make the monster in our head.
And making the monster in our head, that's exactly what made Jaws a perfect horror movie.
You really didn't see a shark very often.
You get an hour into the film without seeing a shark.
And I think that was actually the brilliance of the movie.
All you get is that iconic score.
Radiolab's Lulu Miller and Rachel Cusick talking sharks this week in honor of the 50th anniversary of the movie Jaws. For more wild stories about sharks that glow, sharks that fly, and sharks that might even be able to cure cancer, swim on over to your podcast app and check out Radiolab.
Swimming. It's NPR News.
A new war between Israel and Iran is underway, but what role does the United States play? President Trump has said he wants a, quote, real end to the conflict, but does that mean a new nuclear deal or regime change in Iran? We'll bring you every development in the war between Israel and Iran and follow the next steps for the White House. That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. 10 years ago, a white supremacist killed 9 black worshipers at a Charleston, South Carolina church.
It seems like yesterday. It's still fresh in many of our minds and in our hearts.
How the city's reflecting after the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Senator Alex Padilla of California is encouraging Americans to peacefully protest against the Trump administration's crackdown on immigration enforcement. The senator from Los Angeles was forcibly removed from Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem's news conference last week here in L.A. when he tried to ask a question about the ICE raids and federalizing of National Guard troops and Marines. Here's Padilla speaking on the Senate floor today.
To my colleagues on both sides of the aisle, are we truly prepared to live in a country where the president can deploy the armed forces to decide which duly elected governors and mayors should be allowed to lead their constituents? Is that really the precedent that we're okay with setting?
Last week, Senator Padilla was forced out of the room, shoved to the ground, and handcuffed briefly with plastic zip ties. Meanwhile, Los Angeles is lifting its curfew put in place last week after confrontations with police and protesters over immigration raids in the city. In New York, a city official there was arrested today outside immigration court. From member station WNYC, Charles Lanes reports. City Controller Brad Lander was released a few hours later.
Video shows Lander being led away in handcuffs by two men who appear to be masked law enforcement officials, typical of recent practices by the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Lander, who's running for mayor, said he was escorting a migrant from court and asked to see the person's arrest warrant.
And they would not show me the warrant, and I said I'd let go of his arm as soon as they showed it to me, and they did not show it to me, and you saw what happened.
A spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security said Lander was arrested for assaulting law enforcement and impeding a federal court officer.
You're listening to NPR News. A major pop star joins the race to score this year's unofficial Song of the Summer. NPR's Stephen Thompson has more.
2024 gave pop fans a crowded race for the year's unofficial Song of the Summer, as major stars and new faces flooded the market with massive pop hits. This year, it's been slower, as the pop charts have been loaded with last year's hits, alongside new ones from the country star Morgan Wallen and the ever-present hit Ordinary by the singer Alex Warren. Oh my, it's taking me out, the ordinary. This week, the Song of the Summer sweepstakes finally gets a rowdy pop contender, Sabrina Carpenter's Manchild. Manchild is off to a good start. It debuts on this week's Billboard Hot 100 at number one. Stephen Thompson, NPR News.
Well, retail sales fell sharply last month as consumers pulled back on spending ahead of sweeping tariffs on nearly all imports. Some of the drop was expected after an earlier surge in spending to avoid getting hit with President Trump's tariffs. People spent less at grocery stores and restaurants in May. Meanwhile, the Federal Reserve is meeting to consider what to do about interest rates, which have been on hold this year, to see how Trump's tariffs will affect the economy. Word on that comes tomorrow. I'm Dwayne Brown. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone, and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. As more young people leave rural America, many communities there are aging. That can mean increased social isolation for older adults who stay. So one small town in Kansas is testing a new strategy for boosting quality of life across generations. Rose Conlin of member station KMUW has the story.
The Logan Manor doesn't sound like your typical nursing home. That's because it's also a school. The town of Logan, with a population of less than 500, recently welcomed nursing home residents and students into its new intergenerational facility called the Life Center. By bringing different age groups together under the same roof, administrators hope to foster connection and learning across generations.
Betty, are you doing a staring contest?
Inside, Betty Albright, age 90, is making May Day baskets with three of her friends. Jensen, who's 12, Harper and Harper, who are both 11.
Betty, are we on?
Yeah.
No, we are.
You're on.
Yeah. You're on.
I have a good time with those three. I always know because...
Do you want to sit with us next time,
too? I love them very much.
The setup lets nursing home residents volunteer in classrooms and help with science projects. And it provides learning opportunities for kids. One class is interviewing residents and recording their life stories. High schoolers can job shadow physical therapists and speech-language pathologists.
Llama feels so new.
Right.
Down the hall, 6-year-old Rhett is practicing his reading with 63-year-old Tom Gosha.
Building a castle out of blocks, making a rock from block.
A rock.
Box.
A rock.
From a box.
There you go.
Gosha has pulmonary fibrosis, and he's lived in the nursing home for 5 years. He's a favorite among the kids.
My nieces and nephews are all grown and gone, and they've got kids of their own, but they're in Imperial, Nebraska, Texas, and Omaha. So it's fun to have the little ones around.
7-year-old Rowan says Tom is always willing to discuss one really important topic.
I just like talking to him because he always wants to know about dinosaurs. There's a new dinosaur that I got called a Cicania. So like whenever he roars, he goes...
The Life Center is the brainchild of school principal David Kirkendall. He says not everyone was initially on board.
I've had some people express concern about if this is taking away from the classroom learning.
But he says having the residents around actually adds to kids' learning.
For example, I have a kindergarten grandson, and he can read at the fourth grade level. He can read to a resident at the fourth grade level while the teacher's working with some other students on primary reading aspects.
He thinks Logan could be a model for other communities trying to improve well-being. Teresa McComb, the nursing home's administrator, says she's already seen benefits in the 36 adults who live here.
Even residents that are unable to verbalize how much they like the kids coming over, their faces light up, they smile, they're just in better moods.
The National Council on Aging and other researchers say social contact associated with intergenerational programming can improve mental health in older adults. And Shannon Jarrett, a social work professor at Ohio State University, says children also have a lot to gain.
It builds knowledge about aging, it builds empathy about older adults, and it can have a positive impact on how these young people experience and head into old age themselves. And we know that adolescents have as high or higher levels of loneliness as older people do.
There are also challenges, like how to keep residents safe during flu season and how to maintain relationships over summer break. Administrators say they're more than willing to sort out those details to keep a program so beneficial to young students and the elderly going. For NPR News, I'm Rose Conlin in Logan, Kansas.
Every week, a guest draws a card from NPR's wildcard deck and answers a big question about their life. Jason Reynolds writes young adult novels that don't talk down to kids. His latest book is an audio-only release called Soundtrack, which follows a group of teenagers in New York.
They're all musicians, and they use this music to sort of build family amongst each other as they tour underground, physically underground in the New York City subway system. You know, and it's just an homage to New York City, an homage to young musicians. And it's an homage to what I believe is our most potent form of self-expression, which is music.
On this week's Wild Card, Jason Reynolds talked with host Rachel Martin about his own childhood.
How easily do you cry?
If the ASPCA commercials come on, you're going to, let me say something. The moment I see them dogs and that.
I don't know why I'm laughing. They are very sad.
I can't help it. I am a crybaby of all crybabies.
Are you a crier?
It is my favorite thing about myself.
Why?
Because it reminds me that the expectations of masculinity didn't get me. That I avoided it. That somehow, some way, I was able to maintain a sense of freedom. I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful. And there are moments in which perhaps it puts me in precarious and embarrassing situations, but the people who love me and the people who are around me understand me well enough to know that he's going to need a moment to get this out, and that's it. There's nothing to talk about. I have no problem crying publicly in front of audiences of people because I don't mind telling people that I appreciate folks bearing witness to a man who was able to somehow remain free. I'm grateful for it. I really, really, really am, and I'm grateful for my mother and father for my friends that I grew up with who are still my same friends today, for allowing me space to be myself without forcing me into a box that I do not belong in. So, yes.
I love that as the mother of two boys.
Yeah.
I love it. And I wanna lift that up, and it's hard. It's hard to be a boy.
Oh my God, tell me about it. But this is the reason why I am grateful to have writing. Mm-hmm. I can put it somewhere. Right, and that's what it did for me when I was 10. That's the reason I started writing in the first place. It's because my mom was crying. I was okay. I mean, I was going through what I was going through with my dad, but it was my mom who was hurting. And I was trying to figure out how to make her feel better. And that's the reason I started to write poems for her, to try to figure out how to help her. Right? Mm-hmm. So I think as long as, you know, it's important for people like us to just make sure we have a canister for this. We have to put it somewhere. And then, you know, we'll be able to manage our health differently.
You can watch that full conversation by following Wildcard with Rachel Martin on YouTube. And you can listen to Jason Reynolds' new audiobook Soundtrack now.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Spam is not just for email. Junk messages for one older technology seem to actually be on the rise. Vito Emanuel has the story.
You probably haven't heard this sound in a long time, if ever, but Diane Rosa hears it every day.
We are inside the pharmacy behind the counter where the fax machine is. This is an ancient form of communication from back in the days. We still have it around.
Rosa works at a pharmacy in New York City that still gets faxes on paper. Pharmacies and doctor's offices have clung to the fax machine even as most consumers have left it behind.
How often does this thing go off in a given week?
As of now, it'll go off like maybe like once or twice a day.
And she says about 90% of those faxes are junk.
Sometimes I don't even look at them. I glance at them and it's garbage.
Even though fax machines are fading into obscurity, FCC data suggests that junk faxes are strangely on the rise. Last year, consumers made 40% more complaints about them than in 2022. Dr. Bruce Katz is a dermatologist in New York City. He's drowning in junk faxes.
We can get 60 or 70 faxes a day, but, you know, half of them may be junk faxes. You know, sometimes roofing companies would send us the same fax every month.
And they're not just annoying. Once, Katz had to postpone a surgery when his staff mistakenly threw out a blood test result that got lost in junk fax purgatory.
Enough is enough. I'm going to sue these companies now because they're making my life difficult. They won't stop it if you just ask them nicely, so you have to come back with a hammer.
Not an actual hammer, a lawsuit. Back in the 90s, Congress passed the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. That law gives consumers like Katz the right to sue junk faxers for $500 a page. And when you need to file a junk fax lawsuit, you probably call
Brian Wansa. I'm a principal in a law firm in the Chicago area, and I've been handling junk fax cases since 2003.
Wansa is prolific. He files class action lawsuits where legions of small businesses band together to sue one junk faxer. With enough people and faxes, that money adds up. One lawsuit settled in 2014 for $21 million. And money aside, Wansa hates junk faxes.
It's still a nuisance. It takes you away from your business, and it makes you pay for somebody else's advertising.
Still, suing junk faxers is not so straightforward. First, it might not be possible to identify who's faxing you. Or you might be getting faxes via email, where the law is a lot muddier. Or you might just be one person. And so if suing isn't an option, you can always try the John Epkins method. He used to get junk faxes at work back in the 80s. Here's how he got even. Let's say Epkins got an electronics ad. He'd tape four sheets of paper together in a loop, write,
"Do not fax us again, take us off your mailing list, yada, yada, yada."
And then fax it back to the junk faxer. He let that run as long as he could. During the daytime, someone on the other end might see what's happening and unplug the fax machine.
But if you sent it at 3 o'clock in the morning, you knew there was no one going to be watching that machine, so they would come in the morning and find half a roll of paper on the floor.
Did it work? Did people stop sending faxes?
Yeah, absolutely. We never heard from those people again, yeah.
Katz has stopped using a physical fax machine. Now he gets faxes sent to his email. He still gets a couple junk faxes in his inbox, and this year, believe it or not, the Supreme Court will decide whether he can sue for those ones too. For NPR News, I'm Vito Emanuel.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Charleston, South Carolina is remembering one of the nation's most heinous hate crimes. Today marks 10 years since a white supremacist killed 9 black worshipers during Bible study at Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church. NPR's Debbie Elliott returned to Charleston to hear how people are reflecting a decade later.
That's a familiar and somber sound in downtown Charleston as Emmanuel AME's Gothic bell tower rings out daily at 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. There's a chime for each of the victims, known as the Emmanuel Nine.
It seems like yesterday. It's still fresh in many of our minds and in our hearts.
That's Charleston City Councilman William Dudley Gregory, part of the Emmanuel congregation.
Our family has been a member of that church for probably in the 1800s, way, way back. I can remember, you know, sitting on that fifth row with my mother. I mean, I grew up in that church.
Known as Mother Emmanuel for its role in establishing the AME faith, the church is the oldest black congregation in the South, dating to slavery. So there was no mistaking this symbolism when in 2015, white supremacist Dylan Roof, intent on stoking a race war, pulled out a gun after being welcomed into Wednesday night Bible study. He shot and killed 9 worshipers as they bowed their heads in prayer. Among them was the church's pastor, the Reverend Clemente Pinckney, who was a South Carolina state senator. 5 others survived. Roof is now on federal death row. Gregory says his plan backfired.
The city of Charleston is the seat of the Confederacy. For that to happen in this city, a very hateful person planning a race riot to divide didn't happen in this city. In fact, I think it brought us as a people closer together.
Over the last 10 years, the city of Charleston has taken steps toward racial reconciliation, issuing a formal apology for slavery in what was one of the busiest ports of the slave trade, and establishing a commission to promote equity and inclusion. Gregory says the city is getting there, but the work is not done. He says African Americans have long suffered and sacrificed to bring about racial progress in America.
It's not minorities or African Americans that have to change. It's white people. White people have to change. They control the narrative, the dialogue.
The Emmanuel congregation has long been a part of the story of race in America. The church was destroyed and more than 30 members were executed in the 1820s for planning a slave rebellion. The racist attack 10 years ago is yet another tragedy that Emmanuel has to overcome, says current pastor Eric Manning.
We as the church still experience trauma.
Manning has been the pastor here since the year after the massacre, and it's been a difficult journey for the congregation.
We have the motto, we are a light in the pathway of darkness, and we embrace that. But in this season, at the same token, we have to remember that Mother Emmanuel is resilient, going through a lot, continue to go through a lot, but the church continues to move forward.
Part of that is creating a new space for reflection.
Watch your step.
Reverend Manning leads me out a side door of the church basement where the killings occurred.
As you come in, this is the memorial courtyard area.
It's flanked by 2 elongated white marble benches. A water fountain is being installed in the middle that will be inscribed with the names of the Emmanuel Nine. It's designed by Michael Arad, architect of the September 11th memorial in New York. Manning says the idea is to present a crossroads where people can consider the stakes if hate is allowed to thrive.
And if we think of ourselves as travelers, there are certain key things that we should always try to embrace. One is the acknowledgement of racism, acknowledging the hatred therein, and then working towards a path of reconciliation.
There's a theme you hear time and time again from people touched by the Emmanuel massacre.
there is transformation out of tragedy.
That's the Reverend Sharon Risher, whose mother, Ethel Lee Lance, was among those killed. Risher says her mom was known for a lot of things.
Real perky, snazzy dresser, big smile, always wanting to help.
Risher says she went down a dark hole after the slayings, carrying anger and bitterness that she has now channeled into activism.
This ministry I call now of politics, this ministry of social justice, is something that have grown out of that tremendous pain.
10 years later, she's still pushing South Carolina to pass a hate crime law and lobbying Congress to close the background check loophole that allowed the shooter to buy a gun despite previous drug arrests. Risher says she would have expected to see more progress by now.
Being black in America is just a challenge anyway. And the whole thing behind what happened was hate. And we continue to deal with this.
Other family members also find solace in speaking out against hate.
My name is Melvin L. Graham Jr. I'm the brother of Cynthia Graham Hurd. When she was executed, I made a promise to be her voice.
Cynthia Hurd, a librarian, was at the church that night working on a poster outlining Emmanuel's rich history when a friend asked her to stick around for Bible study. Melvin Graham says the root of the tragedy has been a problem throughout history, not being able to see others as human.
They're not people. They're different. They're expendable.
He sees that kind of thinking in today's debate over immigration and calls it a vicious cycle.
In the past, it was blacks and African Americans that was the cause of all the problems. Now it's Hispanics now the cause of all the problems. Who's next? And that's what scares me the most.
Back at Emmanuel, Reverend Manning is readying for a busy week of memorial events at the church. The congregation is in the world spotlight now. Worship services draw celebrities, international visitors, and tour groups. He wants them to leave Charleston with this message.
Love is stronger than hate, and we're not going to let hate have the final say.
Manning says 10 years after June 17, 2015, is a time to both reflect and find a way to ensure this kind of tragedy never happens again. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Charleston.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from the John D. and...
Break down and let it all out. Break down and let it all out. But now my eyes can see it's all over for you and me, and holding back ain't gonna do no good. So I'm gonna break down and let it all out. Break down.